This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Meredith Monk. She's an award-winning composer, singer, director, and choreographer. I spoke with her on January 11th, 2012, from the studios of APM in St. Paul, Minnesota. She was in a private recording studio in New York City. This interview is included in our show, Meredith Monk's Voice. Download the MP3 of that produced show at onbeing.org.
So if you put those headphones on, I'll go ahead and speak to you over there.
Is there a right, left in particularly, or?
It's a mono signal to your headphones, so don't worry.
Should I take one off or just leave them both on?
It's better to keep them both on because otherwise we might have a delay between the two cities.
Okay. Oh, God.
And, we are connected.
Right, left doesn't matter, though. Which ear? Do you like?
Because you're getting a mono feed.
Okay.
And we are connected right now, so.
I think I'll do this and do the other way where my.
Came to this.
There we go.
Just tell me a little bit about how you came today to the studio, and I'll use that story to set your level.
We got into a taxi, and we came up 6th Avenue, and we were passing Merce Cunningham's studio in the old days of 6th Avenue and 14th Street, and we were talking about it, because he did his last, that company did their last concert on New Year's Eve.
Oh, right. Did he wish that the company dispersed, right? Something
like after that? 2 years, uh-huh.
Wow.
Hi, Meredith. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, it's Krista.
Oh, Krista, I just want to tell you how much I love your show. I listen every Sunday night when I'm in New York.
Well, that just
it's
thrills
so
me.
Great. It's just fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you. And I'm just really excited to have you on the other end of the microphone.
Thank you.
Hey, Paul, can you hear me? Tell Paul I said hello.
Paul, Krista said hello. He just ran
hello,
in the
Krista.
Room.
I was just adjusting the air.
Okay.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. So you know, this is going to be, I think, interesting to do because you've probably done these ISDN interviews before, haven't you? Have you done much of this?
You mean telephone kind of interview?
Yeah.
I did one with Terry Gross many, many years ago,
okay.
And it was great. We had a wonderful time.
Yeah, it's more intimate than you think. But, I mean, what you do is so multidimensional and also visual. But, of course, radio is a visual medium. So
well, my mom was a singer on radio. She used to just do the Muriel Cigar commercials. And so I grew up in radio. I grew up like in a radio booth. Like, you know, I had to be quiet, though. That was a big problem.
Yeah, right. Okay, well, you don't have to be quiet today. And I want to... So I got a list of, and thank you so much for choosing some tracks, some
Good.
Songs. And
yeah.
What I'm thinking is, you know, what we will be able to do, I think, so wonderfully in production is layer that music in to the conversation. But mm-hmm. what I'd like to do, I think, is just let it organically be mentioned and emerge as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
So just feel
mm-hmm.
free to... I'm not going to point at everything. Mm-hmm, at the end, mm-hmm. we can also, you know, we can kind of wrap it up and see if there's some things you want to talk about. But as a song occurs to you, whether it's on this list or not, just, you know, let's talk about it then, and then we can mm-hmm. we can make the magic with the sound.
Okay. Terrific.
Are we ready to go?
Yeah, just a quick thing for Paul. If we could notch the headphones down just a teeny point, and we'll be all set to go.
Okie doke.
Assuming that's still comfortable for Mary.
Try that.
Okay. Are you worried about my...
Actually, Marie, that's much better for
okay.
me.
Okay. Oh, that's better. Okay.
It was a little loud. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Good. Great. Then we can go. Yeah, so you are, I read, a fourth-generation singer. Mm-hmm. And I did find that so interesting that your mother sang for radio, because what it reminded me of is that when I was growing up in a very small town in Oklahoma, I imagined that when I heard a song coming out of the radio, there was a person singing it at my small town radio station, right? I used to think
that.
How exhausted they got that they had to go around to all the radio. But your mother actually was somebody who did that.
She was there every day because in those days there wasn't tape. So she did a soap commercial. It was called DUZ Does Everything, and she did it for a soap opera. And so she was at 1 o'clock every day for The Road of Life, which was... ongoing for years, so it was a live situation every day.
And so your great grandfather was a cantor in Russia.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And was his father also a musician?
I don't know. I just traced it back to my great-grandfather, yeah. and it's just stories. But my grandfather, I knew, and he had come to America from Russia in the late 1900s, and he was a bass baritone. I remember his voice very well, although he was in his 80s when, you know, when I was a child. But he had that beautiful, resonant Russian bass baritone, and he opened a music conservatory up in what is now Harlem, but at that point it was Washington Heights. Mm. And as well as singing all over the New York area, he sang at BAM, Carnegie Hall. They would do recitals with a bass baritone and contralto. Mm. So I have programs of his concerts.
So, you know, it seems to me that, so obviously music was in you from the beginning. It seems to me that there's such an organic link between your art and, you know, what we call spirituality. And I just wonder if that was there in your childhood, was that connection there, whether it was expressed or not?
I'm not sure whether I was aware of it as a little child, but I was very much in love with music, and I remember that I used to sing myself to sleep when I was a child. I mean, it was a very natural, singing was a natural kind of language for me. Mm-hmm. And my mother told me that I would sing things back right away, even before I started talking. And I read music before I read words, actually.
And there's an interesting story in your childhood also that you had some, your eyes were crossed a bit. You had a weak eye and
I
troubles
had the,
with
what's called strabismus. And so that was, did I go over? Do you want to ask that question again, Krista? Did I?
Oh, yeah. No, don't worry. We can edit later.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you want to ask that question?
Yeah.
Then, no?
So you had a weak eye, or you had some trouble with coordination.
I had what's called strabismus, where the eyes don't coordinate. You can't fuse two images into one the way that most people can. So I still look through one eye at a time, although your brain compensates for that. So I'm not aware of that at all. So if I were looking through two eyes, I'd see two images. Mm-hmm. And so I had operations as a child. But I think the right-left coordination was not, that developed. And yet I had a lot of rhythm, natural kind of rhythm as a child. So my mother took me to Dalcroze Eurythmics, which is a wonderful way of teaching music through the body. And I think for me, it was more teaching my body through music. It was a reverse because most kids.
Right, right.
Yeah, so it was so wonderful. And I was looking into Dalcroze. He was a Swiss composer in the late 19th century who had a student who was having trouble with rhythms. And he noticed that the student had a very nice flow through his body as he was walking and running. And so he had the inspiration to teach that student how to hear rhythms through physical kind of exercises. So that was one aspect. So it was very integrative of the body and music. Mm-hmm. And then another aspect was the solfège system. So we did learn how to do the do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do system of scales. And then there was another aspect, which was improvisation. So those three things together make a very holistic kind of way of thinking about music.
And, you know, some people say of you that you have a voice that dances. And this story, actually, that would be one way to describe, actually, how you began with music.
I think that I don't think of them that separate. Mm-hmm. I think of the voice as a kinetic kind of instrument, and I think of the body and the voice as one. So they help each other. And most of the people that I work with in my ensemble come from either a background of music where they're also very open to movement or they're movers or dancers that are very good singers. So that's always something that we work with, the relationship between the two.
And so you described having melodies even before you had words, even before you had sort of classic formal songs.
Mm-hmm,
and it
yes.
seems what's interesting if you look at your stories, you never really left that behind. I'm sure there must have been pressure for you to get classically trained and to do something more traditional. I mean, how did it happen that you resisted that? I mean, you know, how did it possess you that you could do music so differently?
Well, you know, the funny thing is that I wasn't really aware of how much that early background, the Dalcroze, influenced me until I did make an opera for Houston Grand Opera. And because of that situation, there were a few people from my ensemble that were in the piece, but then there were, I had to audition more classically trained people, and we might have heard or seen like about 300 people. It was insane. I would do these long workshops because I think auditions are really hard on the human level. I really like to give something back to people. And also, I was not only looking for people that could sing well, but people that could improvise, people that had a kind of radiant generosity about them and that were very open to new ways of doing things. So, you know, the workshops were more like classes. And so we chose some amazing human beings that I'm still working with to this day. And I would do my rhythms are pretty complicated. And usually in the Western tradition, you don't really have that rhythmic articulation in the same complexity. It's kind of second nature to me. So I would do these rhythms and then I would sort of go off into this very rhythmically complex phrases, and then I'd come back to what would be the one of a phrase, and they'd go, how did you come back? You know, how do you know? And I'd say, I don't know. I mean, it just is completely intuitive for me. And they said, it's that Dalcroze training. And I was like,
really?
Maybe it really had more influence than I realized. Yeah. So that became something that I found out about later. But as far as the classical training, I mean, my mother was not only a radio singer, but she also did classical recitals. And I remember going to her teacher when maybe I was about 13 or 14, and I think it was a little early for me. And there was something that was very uncomfortable for me about it. I was doing a lot of folk singing at that time. I had a guitar, and actually I went to Sarah Lawrence, and I partially earned my way through by singing at children's birthday parties, which was more like really actually being the babysitter, but I did have the kids where I was singing. But I was also in the voice department finally by my junior year, and I was doing leader, I was doing opera workshop, and I mean, it was a wonderful training, and it's a training that I still keep up as, you know, to keep my instrument in tune and to, you know, really keep strong and flexible. But I realized at that point that what I really wanted to do was to create something of my own and to really make my own world, and that there was something about that interpretive form that for me was not right.
Right.
So, you know, it's more that I have a lot of respect for the Western European tradition, but it's really, I'm really trying to do something that makes the voice universal and kind of transcendent.
Mm. Say, Chris, my volume dropped in my headphones kind of drastically. I could still hear, but I could see that it didn't drop for you guys because, no?
No, so your volume...
Now I hear myself.
Do you want me to say something?
Yeah, now
Krista?
I hear you again. Everything's
okay.
Back. Did you
Good.
Change something?
Not really.
It was funny. It was just this dramatic. I could hear the last few sentences, but not well. Anyway, okay, I think we're back. Sorry.
We're going to have to change this now.
Yeah, what you just said, transcendent and something, which had some little mysterious thing happen with the technology.
Universal.
Yeah, universal and transcendent. I recognize this when I read you describing yourself as kind of an archaeologist of your own instrument, of your voice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I thought it might be interesting to just ask you about, you know, discoveries you made, moments when you kind of dug something out and it taught you or changed you.
Well, there's a moment that I always talk about that's... Mm-hmm. Was the mid-60s, and I had already been doing these interdisciplinary kind of works because I think the other part of this way of thinking about things is my idea was to integrate and weave together different perceptual forms. And I think that was because as a child I also had a lot of different interests, you know, movement and images. And when I was still at Sarah Lawrence, I was making pieces combining voice and movement and imagery and gesture and sometimes a little bit of text. So that was early on I realized that was something that was very necessary for me as a psychic necessity, you know, to weave together these different aspects. But then I also realized that there was another resonance, a social resonance, which really had to do with our perceptions as human beings and affirming the richness of those perceptions. And in a very fragmented world that we're living in, coming back to some very fundamental kinds of energies and, you know, the ancient worship forms or, you know, early theater, those forms were really about weaving together music and storytelling and movement, ritual movement. So, you know, there are precedents in the ancient times. Certainly that's the accounts of ancient times. And then you could say in the non-Western European traditions, you know, like African traditions, where you can be a storyteller, a singer, and a dancer, and a master drummer. And, you know, it's really the more things that are within one body, actually, the more honored you are. So it's just in the Western European tradition where these things got separated. And I think I had that instinct that somehow doing this work like this was a way of also healing the kind of fragmentation and specialization that had formed and developed in the world that we're living in. So, you know, that was very early on. So after having done these pieces, these performance kind of pieces, which did have some vocal work within them, but I was really missing the straight out singing, you know, the kind of deep kind of level of singing. So I went back to the piano and started just vocalizing, just regular technical kind of vocalizing. And one day I had the revelation that the voice could be like the body. It could move like the spine. It could jump. It could turn. It could fall. Within the voice were male and female, different characters, landscapes, ways of producing sound. And I had the sensation of something extremely ancient, that it was really going back to a very primal, visceral form of expression, pre-verbal expression. And at the same time, for me, it was almost coming back to my family in my own way, because I think coming from a really musical family is kind of challenging, you know, to find your spot there.
Right, right. So, I've heard that from other musicians, from musician families.
So this was really as if my blood was speaking, and I felt that I was born to do it in a way. So then I started really deeply exploring my own voice and, you know, seeing all the different elements. I think my first exploration was the range, you know, how high and low I could go.
Yes.
And then just different ways of producing sound. And then the music just started coming. And then also I was not uncomfortable not using words.
Right.
Because I had come from also a movement background. And I as much as I love human language and I love to talk and, you know, I love articulation of words, I think that I also trust very much that there are certain energies that we can't talk about, and that to really get to that expression of non-discursive kind of mind, that words get in the way. And so that I immediately started working non-verbally with the voice.
And, you know, that is something that that really became very clear to me as I just kind of immersed in your music, is it is very unfamiliar. So you say we took a lot of things apart, but one thing we definitely put together in Western music, when the voice is involved, is words and music, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and
exactly.
I almost felt some kind of resistance in myself, right? Like that, like, you know, it needed words to be a song. I realized that was a kind of habitual expectation.
That's really interesting. There are the wonderful songsmiths and wonderful people that do put words and music together in such a beautiful way, and you know, it is very enlightening to hear that music, but for me the words get in the way, actually.
Yeah.
Of the heart-to-heart kind of expression that allows for each person to hear it and hook into their minds and hook into their hearts and hook into their memory.
And you know, I'm saying this was kind of an initial resistance, which goes away, and it didn't really contradict, you know, the beauty that I was experiencing. I just think it was an expectation that had to be suspended, how you're used to hearing sung music.
Yeah.
And what you're saying, though, I mean, I think that may also be, you know, maybe there's also a layer of kind of emotional surprise, because as you say, then things are being communicated that do bypass words. And
yeah, because I think emotion or feeling, you know, we have so many more shades of feeling that we can't label. And I guess ultimately as an artist, I'm so interested in uncovering the invisible and the uncovering the mysterious and uncovering what would I say, the inexplicable.
Yeah.
So the things that we actually can't label,
mm-hmm.
that's a kind of, mentality.
Right. Words are always approximate for mystery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when people say that you're a pioneer of extended vocal techniques, you know, how would you explain that? And, what that the origin of that is and what that means to you?
I think it's just that when I had that revelation, I realized that the voice could be used like an instrument. And so it was really more knowing that that anything was possible with the human voice. And I think that that's what people are now calling extended vocal technique. I mean, I've always been loath to categorize anything. And, to even call it like a category like that, it's a way that people can identify something. But I think I was just thinking more in terms of the voice as the messenger of my soul.
Hmm.
And I was just trying to follow it to the best of my ability and to listen to what it needed to do and say. And so that's more the way that I was working.
And so something like Dolman music is... It also becomes kind of an orchestra, vocal orchestra.
Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. It's funny when you hear it, it's kind of hard to realize that there's only six singers. It sounds like
yes.
There might be 12 or 20 or something like
yeah.
that. So it also is very much about keeping the flexibility of not only the voice, but also the mind and the spirit. I mean... The people that were singing with me in Dolman music, I met them when they were very young, and so they didn't have the expectations and having to drop what they had learned, in the way that, say, the people that I was working with for Atlas, which was the opera that I did for Houston Grand Opera, in a way they had to let go of a lot of what they had learned or their habitual behavior. But with these young people that I was working with in the days that we were doing Dolman music, the language of the voice and the way that I was working with it was something that became second nature to them.
Hmm. And how did you watch them? Do you think their careers then were different, their lives in music were different because they did that, had that experience at a young age?
I think that people in that group have gone on to do very different things.
Yeah.
And... But I think that was such a wonderful experience for all of us. So, these experiences that we have that are very intimate, I think that singing together is very, very intimate. And I always say that the music or the images or anything are just a kind of armature for revealing the radiance of these performers. You know, I realized that when I was making Atlas, it was a three-act work. It had a wall that moved and, an orchestra. I was like, oh, just, it was everything but the kitchen sink in there. I mean, not in terms of the form, but I mean, there was another opera going on backstage because the costumes were flying and everything back there. So so it was a big, big production. And I realized at a certain point that, that all of that is very beautiful, but really what was happening there was just an armature to allow for, or a structure or form to allow for these amazing performers, these generous, radiant performers, for that to come across. And I think that performing is, you're so in tune with each other. It's such an amazing template of the possibility of human behavior, of generosity and being there for the other person and, being so sensitive to the environment and to the other people.
You have a Buddhist practice, right? A meditation
mm-hmm.
practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I've wondered, as I was kind of, reading you and watching you, how that, you've talked about singing like the focus, the meditation
mm-hmm.
focus is also there when you're singing, the presence.
Mm-hmm.
And I've wondered if you think that gives you a different relationship to the audience.
Hmm, that's a really interesting question. In a way, I always say that as a young artist, I think I knew some of these, what I would now call fundamental Buddhist principles, but I feel like I knew them intuitively as a young artist and a performer. And then at a certain point, I I was asked to teach at Naropa Institute, and then I, you know, it was through the art, you know, not through the Buddhist practice, but really through the art that I learned about Buddhism. And then I realized all these things that I had had as principles, aesthetic principles, really were fundamental Buddhist principles. So that was really interesting. And one of them is something that you're talking about, which is I always think of the relationship between the audience and the performer as a kind of infinity sign or a figure eight of energy that goes from the performer to the audience and then back to the, from the audience back to the performer. And it's just this constant flow of energy between these two bodies of people. But the beauty of a live performance is that we're all in the same space at the same time.
Right.
And I don't think we have that many situations in the world like that.
You've even
so that's
talked
why I'm a
about
dinosaur.
The audience as a congregation, which is interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like a dinosaur holding out, live performance, you know, not the screen, live performance, because I think that there is something about it that's so unique and it's so necessary to remember again.
And you know, another, I see you when people talk, you used the word transcendence a minute ago, but I always see you also insisting that, you know, that art, that music is about waking up. Mm-hmm. I mean, that I don't know if those two things have to be in tension, but I sense that if you had to choose between transcendence and waking up and being right there in that moment, you would choose the latter. And as you're saying, I mean, live performance is as direct and awake an experience, one hopes, as anything we do.
Mm-hmm. That's also, again, so interesting because actually I don't see those two things as opposites. I actually think that when you are that present and you are that awake and the audience actually experiences themselves, you know, the deepest part of themselves, then the whole situation becomes transcendent because we're not, because our the way we live our lives is not necessarily with that level of presence.
Right.
And also certainly in the society, we're taught to actually be distracted and diverted all the time from feeling, in a sense, you could say, the pain, the good pain, you know, the pain as in open-heartedness and rawness of the moment, the pain as well as the pleasure, everything in one in that moment.
So, you know, one of the words that that has been a subject, an artistic subject for you, is mercy. This is a production, you know, so let's, you know, thinking about, you know, kind of a spiritual notion, a religious notion, certainly a Buddhist notion. The reason that came to me just in, you know, after what you just said is I was talking not too long ago with a great scholar of the Old Testament prophets. There's a different connection for you, okay? But he talked to me about, and I was actually asking him about words that the prophets use that, you know, that he talks about this disruptive language that he actually said that prophets are always poets. Mm-hmm. They're not in the first, and it was very, I think you would like it, really, you know, that they're not issues based, but they kind of create a new imagination and are disruptive in a creative way for people. Mm-hmm. So I was talking to him about words that the prophets use, and mercy was one of them. Mm-hmm. And he reminded me that the Hebrew word for mercy has connotations of the womb, as it does, in fact, the Arabic word.
Oh.
And, but you know what? That sounds so kind of pretty, kind of lovely, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and I said to him, you know, isn't that wonderful? Because the connection of the mother to the child is kind of the absolute moment, the absolute image we have for seeing someone else's well-being as connected to our own. And he said, I'm finally getting to the connection here. He said, yes, because it's so uncomfortable.
Oh, that's so interesting.
And you just,
yes.
And I actually, you just echoed this, but when I was looking at something you wrote about mercy, you know, you said, you use, you know, words like pain, joy, perseverance, continuance, that whole complex. Anyway, I just offer that up to you as something I heard.
That's so interesting. Well, these last years, and maybe mercy was the first time I was very aware of it. I mean, I think for many years, I've been trying to think, how do I how do I really keep on affirming that my Buddhist practice or meditation practice and my art practice are actually one? There's no difference at all. And I think it's more, as I said, when I was a young artist, I intuitively knew these things. But one of the things about practicing over the years, the meditation practice, is just becoming more aware of what I probably already knew, which I guess meditation is anyway. It's about all of us becoming aware of what our basic nature is, which is, you know, that we have this fundamentally good nature. You know, I mean, it's sort of the opposite of the original sin theory. It's the opposite. But anyway, so there was a certain point, it was the early 90s, that I did a piece called Facing North, which was very inspired by being up at Banff, Canada, and the silence and snow and, you know, just this incredible environment. And I was very aware that I was making a very meditative piece and that it was like making a piece about sacred space. So that was, you know, what I was aware of at that point. But when I started working on Mercy, and I was collaborating with a wonderful visual artist, Ann Hamilton, so we did a lot of talking about this, I started becoming aware of that, of the fact that actually I wanted to spend the rest of my life working on pieces that I... It was basically making pieces about something you can't make pieces about. So there was never going to be like a definitive statement about anything, but it was much more that the act of making artwork was also the act of contemplating something. And so Mercy was the first. The second one was Impermanence. And then the latest piece that I've been working on with this way of thinking about things is called Songs of Ascension. So
right, those are the three I wanted to talk to you about.
So, you know, that's just, I don't think my practice of making art is so much different from, you know, the way that it always was, but it's much more just being aware of how do we spend time on this planet? You know, how do you do work that's of benefit? And I think Ann Hamilton and I talked a lot about mercy being, you know, the basic theme of mercy was help and harm.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
say some
aspects
more
of help and harm. Well, it's, you know, it's kind of, I mean, the piece was quite abstract. It was not really, you know, it wasn't situations particularly. And one thing that I think pushed us over to really wanting to make a piece that would be called Mercy was that when I was in Ohio, the first time talking with her and working with her, we happened to see on television there was a news broadcast of, was the time of the Enfitada, and it was there was a young man, a young father and there was a young father and his son. They were in the wrong place at the wrong time, and both of the soldiers from both sides shot them. Even though they were asking for mercy, basically. In other words, they were just coming home from school and they were in a situation and these soldiers could not let them go by.
Right.
So that was pretty shocking. You know, I found that pretty shocking because it wasn't that it was a situation that was any kind of danger or, you know, when the adrenaline goes up or anything.
Mm-hmm.
It was more a situation, there were decisions that were made there and so that was something to think about.
Right.
That was harm, you know.
They were kind of caught in a situation where mercy didn't seem possible.
Couldn't apply or something in that situation. So I think that we started thinking about that and just basic help and harm. We were thinking about, because Anne works a lot with little tiny cameras, and we were thinking about the hand and the mouth. You know, like, for example, that the hand can hold a trigger, you know, can hold a gun, or the hand can actually touch someone, you know, and in the society where there's not a lot of touch. The mouth can scream, you know, the voice can scream, or the mouth can sing a lullaby.
Hmm.
So we did, there were a lot of images of hands and mouths in the piece.
Hmm. In the Songs of Ascension, I mean, Ascension is also a religious image, or it's a very common religious image that you find in different traditions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was interested with that in why does worship always go up? or in a lot of traditions, it's there's this idea of heaven or going up, and how about going down, like, you know, like the earth, say, in Native American cultures. So I was thinking about that, but the genesis of Songs of Ascension came from having dinner with a wonderful friend of mine, Norman Fisher, who is a very fine poet.
Abbott, right?
Yes,
a former Zen Abbot.
He's a former Zen Abbot and a wonderful poet, and we're good friends. And I was just asking him, what was he working on? And he was saying that he was working on translating the Psalms into contemporary language that also took into account his Zen practice. And he also, we both come from a Jewish background, and so, you know, we're both Jew-boos, and so, you know, we have that in common. And he's been going back to actually teaching meditation for Jewish practitioners, people who come from the Jewish tradition. He's teaching Jewish meditation, which is pretty great. And
yeah.
And so he was also talking about Paul Celan, who I was not familiar with, the poet who was a survivor of World War II, who talked about the Psalms that were called Song of Ascents.
Right.
They sometimes are called Songs of Ascent, and sometimes they're called Song of Ascents. And basically what they are songs that are always about climbing up the mountain to the temple. And there were 15 stairs that went up to on the top of the mountain, there were 15 stairs that went to the temple. And so people would take a step and then sing a psalm and then take the next step and sing a psalm. And so to me, that was so fascinating. And also there were instruments as well. And so this idea of procession or walking and making music as a form of worship was very fascinating to me. And so then I started also thinking about Mayan cultures. And in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, there's circumambulation. So it's I'll say that again.
Yeah.
You can edit this.
Yeah.
Circumambulation. So that's a different form. So it's going around. But the stupas are also vertical, forms. So these things were just going through my mind. And you know, music in space and music as worship.
And you did this in this tower, in Ann Hamilton's tower. You performed that? Is that right?
Yes, it is. After we had done Mercy, she had mentioned to me, but it was kind of in the back of my mind, she was working on a project that she had been working on for, I think it ultimately was 18 years. In Northern California, Steve Oliver has a ranch up in Sonoma County, and he has site-specific sculptures all over his land. And I think he had been in, and I think he still does do a lot of construction work, and so he's very interested in engineering. So the artists have made work for the land, but then with his help and his engineering savvy, and he's an amazing person. So she was telling me she was working on this tower, and then after I talked to Norman, I was also making a piece for Kronos String Quartet, and I was thinking about the next step was to think about the voices in relationship to the strings. So I'd made a string quartet, but then I loved the idea of working with voices and strings because the bowing arm is so much like the breath. So, you know, they're really comparable. So Anne called me up and said, you know, we're going to finally finish the tower, and would you sing for the opening of the tower? And I said, I'd love to, and I want to tell you I'm working on this piece called Songs of Ascension, and maybe we can really figure out a way that I can make it for the tower. And so we went and sung for the opening, but we did more repertoire, like a cappella repertoire. And then we ended up, I started to get to know the acoustical thing, which is really interesting because the tower is 8 stories high, but it's not very big in terms of how far away you are from each other. And it's got a double helix staircase
that go up to the top.
And so that also, that DNA, the idea of DNA seemed so interesting to me. And how would you make a musical structure that had that double spiral kind of form? I'm not sure I successfully did that, but I mean, it was very inspiring to work with it. And how DNA has that core, but then it has all these little offshoots. And how would you work with that musically and visually and, you know, with the body? So,
and you also had the musicians were all over the place in the tower, right?
Yes, and the audience, the way that the double helix works is that the audience is on one strand, and then the performers are on the other strand. But if you looked at it, you actually wouldn't know how it worked exactly because you never can reach where the audience is except to go over the top and back around, but you're really close to the audience. So in a way, the audience and the performers are woven together. It's such a beautiful situation.
You're
and
like
so
on parallel staircases.
We're on parallel staircases, but we can never reach each other.
But you know what struck me also, though, is it's Songs of Ascent, of Ascension. But when I watch this, it's the circular. I mean, there's the moment where everything goes up and down again, right? So it was actually circular. It wasn't just up.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I know that maybe the song, maybe I should have called it Songs of Going Up and Down.
but maybe Ascension always has going down in it or something, you know?
I think it does. I think there are two parts of the, you know, we have the heaven principle, the mm-hmm. earth principle, and the human principle, and you weave them together, and that's how they're, you know, they're unified.
Yeah.
So it had both aspects. But also the acoustical situation in that tower was so unique. And, you know, to be able to even hear each other was so interesting. So I was just trying to work with, you know, just that very extreme. Like sometimes something would come from way down at the bottom. Hmm. And the rest of the performers would be way up at the top. But the one performer would be way down at the bottom. And the audience couldn't see the entire thing. But you could hear the whole thing.
Hmm. You know, this is true of your art, but it's also true of your Buddhism. I want to say this. You know, it's always a cliche to imagine that Buddhism is just about, you know, sitting down, following the breath, or making your mind empty. You know, right? That's the simplistic cliche. But I really see you kind of living and working with this narrative, playful kind of melodrama that's there in Buddhist tradition, right? Stories about mm-hmm. Milarepa in the cave and the mm-hmm. demons coming in and mm-hmm. inviting mm-hmm. them to tea. There's a playfulness in your art and in the way you bring your spiritual sensibility into that. Do you know what I'm talking about? Are you?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think it's something, you know, play is something to really think about, you know, mm-hmm. because I say that to myself. You know, right now I'm working on a commission for a San Francisco symphony, and I just keep on saying, remember playfulness, Meredith? When I'm like at the piano, just like, oh my, how am I going to do this? But I mean, I think that sense of playfulness is the sense of being alive. That's another aspect of being awake. Mm-hmm. And the fluidity, it's really about fluidity, about being so in the moment that you are in pinpoint focus, but at the same time, you're completely open to what the moment has to give you or to tell you. And I think that has to do with the playfulness and that. And people can feel that. You know, I think that that's what you're giving an audience, is that spirit of the give and take that playfulness implies.
Right. It's awake and it's responsive.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And light. I think there's something which is also about Buddhism, you know, the wonderful practice. And certainly you hear that a lot in the Zen, with the Zen practice with Suzuki Roshi and, you know, all these, you know, these masters that are just saying, lighten up.
Right. Don't take yourself so seriously. Don't take me so seriously, your teacher, right?
Exactly. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the beauty of Buddhism, is that the Buddha was a teacher, and it's not a theistic tradition. And then it's much more about... you know, he always said, don't believe what I say. Find out for yourself.
Yeah. So I would love to talk about impermanence in that project. And I know that that has also been connected with life for you.
Very much so.
Mm-hmm. So would you tell that story?
Well, I lost my partner of 22 years. So that was in a sense, that was the biggest wake-up call that I ever had in my life up to that point, and probably from that point on, because I think that when you have that kind of loss, nothing can ever be the same. And it was a blessing, you know, I also saw the blessing, not the blessing of the loss, but the blessing of being part of life, and the blessing of being aware of the billions of people that go through loss all the time.
Right.
So, you know, in a way, I feel like you can be compassionate of other people's pain, but if you really haven't experienced it, it's really hard to know what that really does to the way that you think about life and death. So it was very profound. And I really tried to not separate myself from the grieving process or not try to defend myself from the grieving process, but to really go right into it and right through it. And I knew that there was never going to be an end. You know, it's kind of a... it's really a folly to tell, you know, to say to someone, well, have you gotten over it? Or, you know, has there been closure? I mean, there really never is.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, is the beauty of knowing that we will be here and gone. You know, the light goes on and the little light bulb goes off, but you leave love behind. I mean, really, when it comes down to it, you just leave love behind. That's what it comes down to. The Beatles had it right. all you need is love. I mean, it's really true. And so, you know, there was it was such a feeling of being part of the sea of life, the sea of humanity, and the raw heartedness of life that makes you appreciate so much the moments that you have. So, you know, that's what I'm so grateful. So what happened that was really interesting was that about 2 months after she died, I got an email from a group in England that they call themselves Rosetta Life. And what they do is that they go into the different hospices in England, and they work with the people that have had the diagnosis of terminal illness. And they say, well, is there any kind of artwork that you would like to do? You know, would you like to write a poem about your process or about anything? Would you like to, you know, make some music? And then they'll get an artist to go in and help them. Hmm. So, you know, if somebody wants to make a painting, but they've never painted in their lives, but they feel that that's the way they're going to express this process, somebody comes in and helps them. A painter comes in and helps them to make a work. And so they said, well, we're going to have a festival of these hospice patients' work, and we'd like you to make some music. I think it was for a play, or it might have been a play of some of the stories of these people that were in this process. And would you do that? And I said, well, I actually don't work that way, you know, with stories and narrative that much, but I would really actually like to make a piece, a total piece. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of nothing but impermanence, so I think I'll call it the Impermanence Project. And, you know, I'd like to make the whole piece. And so, and then, of course, after I started working on it a few months later, I said, what was I thinking? You know, so again, it was this, how do you make a piece about impermanence? It's impossible. You know, it's like an oxymoron to make a form about impermanence. A project about impermanence. Yeah. So, but I knew that, well, I got actually on a long retreat that I did up at Gampo Abbey, which is up in Canada, in Nova Scotia. Of course, I was supposed to label it thinking immediately when I got the idea, but I did keep it in my mind, I have to admit. But I got this image of...
okay.
Don't tell anybody,
you get
okay?
a B in meditation. Right.
Yeah. So I got the image of a crystal, like holding a crystal in your hand, and that you look at these different facets or faces of a crystal. And that if I started working that way, in other words, that we're glimpsing at this one facet of impermanence, and then we turn it over, and maybe the next facet has nothing to do with the first facet, but we're seeing another side of it, that would actually be a beautiful structure. Mm. And so what the first part of impermanence is that each of the sections, we actually say the name of the section. So if I'm singing Last Song, I just say Last Song, and then I sing it, or we have another section called Particular Dance or Seeds. Or, you know, there are different titles of the sections, or Disequilibrium is another section. So so it's very honest, and I thought that was a good way of trying to work with it. And then the other part of it was that they had asked me if I could do something with the hospice patients. And so we had this wonderful workshop. I came to London, and mostly we were just doing a lot of talking. People were laughing a lot. And a lot of it was about pain management and just about their experiences. And I think the second one I did, which was a few months later, I asked them about their idea of their own death. And they had these amazing images. Like one said that she wanted to be shot up into the air like a rocket and then sort of flow down, you know, onto the earth or something. You know, it was sort of that idea. Or her ashes. I guess she wanted her ashes to be shot up into the air and then the ashes would come down. Onto the earth. And, you know, people had these amazing imaginative ways of thinking about their own dying. But the first one was really more about, you know, pain and how they had been so surprised by these diagnoses. And so I sang The Tale, which is a very funny piece, where it's about this old woman who... you know, is talking about, I still have my hands, ha, ha, ha. It's like one, it's one of my songs that actually really has text, but it's more like a sort of litany. Oh. And then I sang, so they loved that, you know, because it was really funny, and they said, we want to hear this bit again, we love that. And then I sang Last Song for them, and because I had started working on it, and they some of them said that it was actually almost too much, that it was too close to the process that they were going mm-hmm. through. But then they said the more they heard it, they could have heard it all night. So, you know, it was became this kind of also something really intimate for them.
See, that's what, and, I wonder if that's, you know, what I was saying earlier, that because your music cuts through very quickly and immediately
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
to things that mm-hmm. in a way words may act as a shield or, you know, the traditional way we do things.
Well, you know what's ironic about that, Krista, is both of those pieces have words.
That has words?
because Last Song has also another litany of just words that come from a wonderful text by James Hillman.
Okay, so it's the language also that was reaching them. Why do you sometimes decide to add words? I mean, how do you know that? You just, because that's pretty rare for you, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the way that if I do use words, they're really used more abstractly. It's not like... if you hear the words, you actually are, a story is being told.
Right.
It's actually more almost like a chant yeah. is the way that I think about it.
Yeah.
Like both The Tale and Last Song have this sense of the word as litany. And I think in Last Song, what I was going for was the idea of saying a word, but then little by little, the word dissolves into pure sound.
Well, see, that's still different from...
It's still different
from
the way that, you know, singing a song where mm-hmm. the song is actually giving you the content
exactly.
in a way. So what I ended up doing, because they wanted to, they asked if I could do something where they were in, or their experiences, or they were actually in the piece. And that became difficult for me, because it's hard for me to work that way. And so what I ended up coming up with was that the piece began with hearing them sing a melody called Mika's Melody Number 5, which was a melody that my partner... she used to like to just improvise in the studio, even though she was not a singer. And I happened to come upon a tape of some of these improvisations. Mm. And so what I did was I notated one of them, and then I actually changed it a little bit and, you know, made it more into a form and added some of my own phrases. So it was a little bit like a collaboration through time and space. And so I wrote out the melody, and because they said, oh, we love to sing. And so I wrote the melody out for them, and then they sang it, and they couldn't really carry a tune that well, but it was so, each of them sang it, you know. So the melody goes like, ayo, 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 zo, ayo, ayo, zo. So, you know, that was the melody. And then they'd be going like, ayo, 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 zo. And so each of them had a different way of doing it. And so when the audience came in, they heard their voices. And then I had a film of just their faces, just looking straight out at the camera, very, mm. very, very close. And so when they came to see it, the ones that were still alive by the time we did Impermanence, it just meant so much to them. And then also their families, for the ones that had passed before we ended up doing the piece, it meant so much to them.
Right.
So they were actually really present in the piece. So that was another aspect that was really beautiful.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm. I hope my answers aren't too long.
No, they're
sorry,
great. No, you know, this is the, no, it's not on and on. It's a real conversation. It's so wonderful. I have to say, because my medium is radio, I'm just also hearing how we're going to be able to weave your music throughout it. And it's going to be so beautiful. So I can
the only thing
that
you don't have is the tale. I wonder whether we should send you the tale.
Well, we can find it. Or if we can't,
yeah, you can
we'll
find it
you.
Easily. It's on Dolman Music on ECM. It's easy
we'll
to find
it.
Yeah. Okay.
So, I mean, this whole notion of impermanence and the death of your partner, it's clear also that it's been for you, it's also coincided with you thinking about aging. And I've, you know, I've seen you out there talking about that, talking with Bjork about that. And you talked to Bjork about that,
mm-hmm,
about aging.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in Buddhist fashion, I mean, also talking about these things as teachers, I have to also say that there's such a fluidity in your body and your movement. I mean, I'm not sitting across from you, unfortunately, but watching you on video, that kind of feels ageless, and your braids are ageless also. Is that something that you're working with? You know, how are you experiencing that? Or how do you think your art shapes the way you might be experiencing that?
Well, I've been noticing that the older that I get, the simpler the work gets in a way. Mm. I mean, in a way, it's more refining it from something very complex to something very simple. And that within simplicity is complexity. And I think as a young artist, it was much more, the surface was more complex. I was working with film and, you know, weaving all these elements together. But I think that as I've gotten older, I've just realized that that the most essential is what reaches people the most. You know, that's what it seems to me now. Mm. And, you know, so I think a lot about space within in the work and time and space. And so I think it's more that one of the beauties of being an artist is that it is timeless. And, you know, the funny thing is that it doesn't get any easier. I mean, you would think that you've been, you know, I've been working for so many years that, oh, I can make a piece so easily. But I think what I do is I put myself through the same process of going to zero every time.
Right.
And, you know, this kind of risky situation. And so sometimes I'm, you know, I think, why do I do this? And why, you know, isn't it more easy now after all these years? But I actually think that that's what does keep you very young, you know, because you're always questioning. Mm. You know, I think that making art is actually about questions and that you never take anything for granted, and you're in this slightly danger situation, which I think is really good. And then I always say that I'm scared to death, and I think you know, what we learn in Buddhist practices to tolerate the unknown, you know, because that's reality. The reality is that we don't know anything, and we really don't know what's going to happen in the next moment. And so you learn to tolerate that discomfort of not knowing. And fear. I mean, I think every time I'm just terrified. I'm actually terrified. I realize this
every
even
time
now working on this piece.
When you
every
perform,
time.
When you write, when you're
no.
creating something?
Well, when I perform, I'm still nervous, which I think is a good sign, mm-hmm. because it means that you still have passion for what you're doing. But every time I make something new, it's never like, oh, this is going to be so easy. No, it's always this terror. And then I sit with that for a while, and then I say to myself, step by step. And then I just start working, and it's a step-by-step kind of process. And then at a certain point, I realize I'm so interested in this. And then once that interest comes in or curiosity comes in, then the fear goes away.
Hmm.
And so it's very interesting that curiosity is a great antidote to fear.
Mm, it is. That's a lovely, lovely thing to think about. You do work. You work with a lot of people, right? I mean, you just told the story about the people in hospice, and mm-hmm. you teach and train, and I mean, you seem to just there seems to be so much teaching also that goes on even as you're creating a performance. I wondered if do you have any just kind of lessons that are contained that you might be able to do for our listeners. I was reading something about click songs. I don't know if that's something you can teach. That's a huge, complicated
thing,
right?
That's pretty hard, yeah. Well,
is the way there that anything, we teach... Yeah, tell me.
Go ahead, excuse me. Why don't you finish that up?
No, I'm just wondering if there's anything that you might be able to do that we could... where people could just have a moment of that teaching.
Teaching over the radio?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, if you can't do it, you can't, but see what you think. Is there anything?
Well, oh, gosh. I mean, it's... I don't know if I could do that. I don't know if I could do that, Krista.
Okay, that's all right.
To be totally honest with you.
We're in time for just a few more minutes. If you have a brain flash, you tell me.
The way that we teach, and my ensemble also teaches a lot, is we do workshops, and a lot of them have to do with getting in contact with all these different aspects, like, you know, with the voice and with the body, with the breath. And then sometimes we teach some of the repertoire that people can learn, so they have the experience of the joy of singing and performing some of this music. But then the other aspect is also to get people in touch with their creativity and, you know, how different aspects of how do you make something, you know, because I think making something is ultimately is such a joy. So that's really what the teaching is about. And in a way, it's also... it's kind of a teaching of a way of thinking about things, mm-hmm. you know, which is this kind of anything is possible mentality, and not having barriers between things and not having categories, but really actually using all the elements that we have as human beings and affirming that width and that at the depth that we all have, and then that's the same way that we affirm the incredible scope that the audience has. So I think that way of thinking about things is what we also teach in, it's a kind of philosophical workshop as well as it is about performing.
I know some journalist was writing that the one thing that happens when someone listens to you, when you hear these songs, this music come out of your voice, then you want to see if you can do that with your voice. And I found that to be absolutely true. So I've been walking around
clicking?
Singing. No, not clicking. I haven't tried that. But, I mean, it's interesting because, and it, I think maybe counterintuitive, because what comes out of your mouth is not like other songs that you've learned in your life, right? It's it's recognizable as music, but it's different, and yet it feels familiar, right? It feels like something you take in and want to take in.
Well, I think that it's actually all of us as human beings are part of the world vocal family. I like to think that all of us are part of that world vocal family, and there are these. When you start exploring your voice, there are sounds that you find that do transcend a particular culture. You know, they're used in different ways in the culture, but they are sounds that are part of the vocabulary of the human voice, and the human voice is the original instrument. So you're going back to the very beginnings of utterance. Mm. And I think that's why when you hear it, it brings up, you know, in a way, it's like the memory of being a human being.
Hmm.
Hopefully, you know, I mean, that's what I would like people to get in touch with. So, and then sometimes the songs sound very simple to do, but they're actually really hard.
Right.
So sometimes people, you know, I've had choruses of really good people, and they think, oh, you know, we can just read this down, and it's going to be so easy. I'm like, I'm not sure. And then when they end up working on it, they're like, oh my goodness, this is really hard. So it's deceptive in that way.
Mm-hmm. I think you know, you may have just answered this question and you may have just had your last words, but I did that's kind of where I wanted to come with you, is, you know, how this way you've lived your life through these media of music and art and also your Buddhist practice, you know, how has your idea of what it means to be human, you know, how do these things shape that in a particular way? Where are you with that right now?
Well, I think, you know, what I'm so grateful for every day is just that I've been able to do what I love. And I see that that's not always the case with people's lives. And I don't know what it was as a young person, but I somehow knew that I was going to follow this path wherever it was going to lead. And sometimes it's very lonely, but at the same time, it's just such a blessing to be able to do that, to be able to try to listen to what life has in store for you and, you know, what's being said to you, and then to try to follow it, and that, you know, just whatever that takes. And so it has a lot of challenges, and maybe some people would not want to exactly go that path, but it doesn't, you don't have a precedent to know what the next step on that path is going to be.
Right.
And so that's and I'm so grateful for it. I mean, I just can hardly believe that, you know, that I've had this life. That has been so incredibly rich in so much love, you know, and music and art. I mean, it's something that, how can you even articulate the scope of that, you know, that you are part of that, that you've been allowed to be part of that, and that you've been allowed to share that with people all over the world, that we've traveled all over the world and have shared this, and then these amazing people, you know, in my life that have helped me so much. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's been a wonderful life. It's the name of a movie. But, it really has.
Yeah. Is there anything else, any song or work that you'd like to talk about or something you're working on now? What are you working on now?
Well, right now I'm working on a piece for San Francisco Symphony, which is, I'm calling Realm Variations right now, because I'm working with very, very high instruments, low instruments, and medium instruments, and sort of exploring those worlds of these different realms. But
you mean instruments as in vocal instruments or different
voices and instruments?
Okay.
A piccolo, you know, the commission was to make a piece for piccolo, which is an instrument that I don't know well at all. And then I'm working with very low instruments like contrabass, clarinet, and then so it's seven players and six voices. And so I have two high singers, two medium singers, and two low singers. So I'm just working on these different realms of sound, and also they're almost like little landscapes. But this piece will be part of something I've been thinking about for the last few years, which is the working title is On Behalf of Nature, and I'm really been thinking a lot about ecology and, you know, our world, as many people are, and it's, again, another piece that you almost can't make a piece about. And where that title, On Behalf of Nature, it comes from, and I may use it, I may not, but, I mean, it's a good working title for me. It comes from some of the early essays of Gary Snyder, who was saying that, you know, making art
is... He's a Buddhist poet, right?
Buddhist poet, mm-hmm. and very a person that's always been involved with the environment for, you know, since the 70s. Yeah. And so he... You know, in an article that I read of his, he said, well, art is speaking on behalf of nature. So it's actually giving voice to, you know, what might be, you know, might not be able to be heard. So that, it just seems so interesting to me. And I've been, you know, I don't really know what I'm doing in terms of the large work yet, you know, images or anything. But, I mean, it's something I'm, again, contemplating. But the music that I'm working on now, I'm sure will be part of this piece. So that's the project that I'm doing right now.
Is there anything else you feel like you want to sing? Talk about?
Do you want me to talk anything about the songs that you have, or, you know, are you okay, Krista?
Well, we definitely have enough. I mean, there's so much here to work
material,
with already.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But if there's one of them you want to talk about in particular, I welcome that.
Well, there's one song that I would like to wait. I'll start better than that. One song that's an unusual song for me that also does have a little bit of text in it is a song that I wrote when I first started doing the formal sitting practice, which was in the mid-80s. And most of my songs deal with emotion, you could say between the cracks of emotion. You know, they're not really... dealing with a particular, you know, anger or something that you can point your finger at. I usually think of them as the shades between the emotions, and that the voice can dig those shades of emotion out. But I got very inspired. My early practice was in the Shambhala training, which is was created by Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, and the Tibetan Buddhist teacher. And these teachings usually come out during times of hard times in the world. Shambhala was a mythical kingdom that was ruled by an enlightened king who asked the Buddha to not come with his monks, but to basically come and teach him how to have enlightened society. That's the tradition. And in many, many different Asian countries, Shambhala is like a mythic kingdom. It's not only in the Tibetan tradition. So... the teachings came to him, you know, at a certain point, and he started teaching them, I think, in the beginning 80s. I may be wrong historically, but he brought them to his students. And so it's very much about how do you become a citizen in this world, very simple, down to earth. Your practice is very simple, but it's very much about how are you in the world? You know, how do you look at the person that's counting change for you in the grocery store, or how do you deal with a person that you don't get along with well? You know, how are you waking up all the time to see what the moment is? How are you on the subway? You know, how are you when something really bad happens to you? You know, just how do you become a citizen in this world? And perpetuate nonviolence, and, you know, there are many, many aspects to it. And one of them is the second level of Shambhala training is about fear and fearlessness. And it's about acknowledging your fear rather than pushing it away, because a part of the violence comes from not even acknowledging that you're afraid. It's actually that you're afraid of the fear.
Right, but acting.
And then what happens
is
that gets pushed down, and then that gets transformed into anger or violence. You know, I mean, it's really so much of the world that we're living in now, you know, what's going on and the way that people are manipulated, or these wars or violence violent situations come from basic fear and terror, you know, and not in terms of terrorism, but terror. Human terror. Mm-hmm. So I started thinking about that, and then I started working on a song that's called Scared Song.
Right.
And, yeah. And so I think that that's quite an unusual piece for me because it really is dealing with a very specific emotion.
I want to tell you something funny. In that,
please.
On the list, it's misspelled. It's called Sacred Song.
So, did somebody type that up wrong? Or I think that's in iTunes. They have it as Sacred Song.
Somewhere I saw it, but it's an interesting mistake. I thought.
Isn't it?
Yeah,
I was thinking about that too. How interesting. You know, maybe the computer saw Scared Song and then changed it to Sacred Song.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because how could there be a song called Scared Song? That's impossible.
Right.
So in that one also, I do have words, but again, they really kind of disintegrate into states of being.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, they're really used in a pretty abstract kind of way.
Yeah, and the fear, the scared is experienced as much as it's spoke as it's a word, right? I mean, it's it's in your voice. It's communicated
kind of
three-dimensionally.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's an unusual song, and that it might be interesting to have that.
Mm. Well, this has just been really wonderful, and yes.
Pickup when you were talking about the Intifada.
Yes.
Meredith had referred it to as
Intifada.
We'd love her to say it one more time because she said she said infantada.
Okay. I knew it. I did
just
it wrong.
Just like scared sacred, you said infantada.
Yeah. So should I just say the word?
During the Intifada.
Okay. During the Intifada.
That's fine.
Yeah.
I knew I had done it wrong.
We can probably digitally manipulate it, but thank you for that.
I just hope that we have the pleasure of meeting face-to-face because, as I said, I listen. When I'm in New York, I listen every Sunday night. And it's just I just have loved the what you're doing. It's so incredibly inspiring. I love the talks with the scientists, and I loved the talk that you did with that extraordinary a man who is living in Israel, but comes from a Muslim background.
Muhammad Darawshe,
he lives in the Galil, and then he was, I've been to Israel a few times, and then just the idea that they basically headed for the hills, they were not going anywhere.
Yeah.
They just came back to live, and so I think that there's so many people that don't even think about that community.
Yeah. Right.
What an extraordinary man.
Yeah, I love telling those sides of the story that are so important told because they don't turn into headlines.
And I feel that we don't know, I mean, I haven't been in Israel in many years since the mid-80s, but there's the people that I knew in Israel, I mean, they were so pro-dialogue, and there are so many people in Israel that we never hear about here.
I know.
That come from such a different point, the Israelis themselves that come from such a different point of view, and we never hear that point of view.
Yeah, I mean, they're more anguished than anyone outside could be.
Oh, so it's very complicated, and of course everything is simplified in the news here, and it's a very sad situation.
Yeah, well,
and so is what's going on in Tibet. Really, like, wow.
Right.
Because I just did a pilgrimage to India and Bhutan.
Right.
And I ended up in Dharamsala because I sang for His Holiness.
I saw that.
The Dalai Lama at the end of 1999. And we were, and talk about playful. He loved the singing. And I decided to do three songs that had some humor because I had seen a documentary about him where he said, I don't like music or I don't listen to music. The man said, well, what kind of music do you listen to? He said, I don't listen to music. I don't like music. And so, I mean, he probably didn't say I don't like music, but he said, I never listen to
laugh.
Music. But he loves to laugh. Yeah. So I thought, well, what am I going to sing for this man? So I sang one piece called Porch, which was more spacious and, kind of opening the space. It was more like an invocation kind of piece. And then I sang Click Song Number One, which he loved. He kept on looking, like, how is she doing that? And then I did the Jews harp piece.
Well, he has throat singers, of course, so.
Yeah, but it was like two young children just loving each other so much. Mm. And so, what a person. So I was able to have 3 days of teachings with him. There were maybe 2,000 or 3,000 people there. I mean, it was amazing. Mm-hmm. And then we that was the point, at that point, that some of the monks were, immolating themselves, in protest.
Yeah.
And so we got to hear a lot of what was going on. And it's such a sad situation.
Yeah.
It's very close to what happened to the Native Americans in the United States.
Although I think it will be more visible, you know, somehow there may be some hope in that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I think this is the irony. We are actually watching that process in a way that people didn't watch it, you know, when that happened here.
Yeah.
But it's very much the same kind of situation where culture is actually getting erased. And I think that that's what His Holiness is most concerned about. It's more, you know, that's why he's saying maybe it's not going to be independence, but he wants autonomy so that the culture is not destroyed.
Yeah. It's interesting that he's removed himself from political power. You know, it'll be interesting to see how that changes. I mean, we probably won't see that in our lifetimes, but how that will change the tradition.
Yes, I think he's in such a difficult, you know, I think that he was in such a difficult position that there was no, that he felt that maybe it was not of benefit, you know, I mean, in his mind.
I think that it left the religion, it left the culture in a way vulnerable to other politics.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Well, I hope we meet someday, too. I really
do. Me too, Krista. And also, I love the book, too. I mean, I'm a real fan.
Thank you. Well, it's a mutual admiration society.
Thank you. And
we're thrilled. When we produce this, you'll know. We may have some questions, but I can't wait to do this now. And
Thank you so much, Krista. And also, I loved the Roseanne Cash was so great. I mean, she was saying a lot of the stuff that I feel like she
there
was...
There were real echoes. Isn't that interesting?
I'm telling you. Yeah. I was just like, I would also love to meet her to just say thank you, because she was just articulating so much of the same ways that I think about things.
Yeah, and you're such different artists. I mean, it's just...
And we're such different artists, yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I hope we get to continue this conversation sometime. Thank you
so much, Krista.
Bye-bye.
Bye.